Welcome to the Next Brave Thing podcast. My name is Ella Hooper, and I believe that breakthrough is on the other side of bravery. This podcast features brave stories, emotional health, and creativity to inspire you to take your next brave step.
Chantel, thank you for coming back on my podcast.
Thank you for having me again.
This is our third attempt at recording this.
The first.
No, because remember we tried to record a podcast when I was in New York.
And then my thing didn't work.
The Zoom,
the headphone situation.
Yeah. And then the second time we recorded it, but for some reason your audio in it didn't work.
I'm not the most tech savvy person.
Yeah, but that was definitely my fault because
I forgot it's our third time.
This is our third time.
All right. Resistance is real, but it's meant to be.
It's meant to be. And I'm excited because you were on my first season. We spoke about friendships. I still to this day get so many people writing in saying...
People message me about it.
Yeah.
About the friendship podcast. Yeah.
It's so good.
Yeah.
I know. So good. But it's exciting because you're in the studio and people can see what you look like. Hi, guys.
There's three cameras looking at me, so I don't know which one.
Yeah. Yeah. But I'm excited to have you because you have your master's in counseling psychology.
Mm-hmm.
Did I say it right this time? Great. And you're also, just this past year, become a professor at Simpson University.
I did.
Yes. Yeah. Tell me a bit about that real quick.
It came out of nowhere. Basically through a connect that my husband had, brought up to the director of the Masters of Counseling program that I have my master's in counseling. I do trauma work with women. And so then she just emailed him and the subject line was Chantel as a professor ? And basically just offering me a adjunct professor. So adjuncts are like, we just come in to teach certain courses.
Yes.
And so right now, last semester I taught family therapy, postmodern approaches to family therapy. And then this semester I'm teaching human sexuality.
So, hot topic, guys.
I was, I don't know if I can say the words on the podcast actually. I was joking with my students that I'm just going to have to stand in front of my mirror and say sexual words all Christmas long so that I
so you don't giggle?
Don't bless your giggle.
I would definitely giggle.
So that's where I'm at.
Totally.
But yeah, it's been a cool opportunity, a very big learning curve to learn how to teach people. You know this, how to teach people, capture people's attentions. I think for me, they're 3-hour lectures and I thought, oh, I can talk for 3 hours, but it's actually a very it's an art form and creativity takes a lot of creativity to learn how to engage people for 3 hours.
Yes.
And teach them so that they learn.
And it's not like 2 weeks. It's
seven. Yeah.
Yeah. And you do it twice a week. It's a lot.
Yes. I'm only going to do one.
Okay.
This semester, but
yes. Oh my gosh. Yes. I know it's a lot of work, a learning curve for sure.
I admire teachers so much more now that I am one.
Yes. And so you are, even though you've got your master's in psychology and counseling, you are actually a life coach. So tell me about why you took the life coaching direction.
Yes. The short answer to that is because I'm a Canadian and originally in Canada, I was on the track to become a licensed psychologist, a licensed clinical psychologist. And I was going to get my master's and then go on to get licensed and registered. But then obviously I moved to the States, then I got married, and then I settled my life here. And because of licensure in different states, let alone different countries, I would have had to do so much upgrading and different courses to be able to fit a California standard of a master's degree and then go on to do 3,000 hours, get a PhD. It was just a really long journey towards going after what I was already kind of close to doing back home. And by this point, I was already pregnant with my first. And so life coaching was kind of not coming on the scene, but it was getting more, people were becoming more aware of it and it was getting more credible.
Yeah.
And so the difference between life coaching and therapy is big. I call myself a therapeutic life coach because I kind of blend the two worlds together. Mm-hmm. But a life coach is oftentimes they're more forward focused, goal oriented. How can I come alongside you, be your accountability, ask you good questions so that you can move towards goals, what it is that you're trying to go after. And from a practical standpoint, as a life coach, you don't need any certifications or mm-hmm. qualifications. Technically, it's
yeah.
wise to get.
Yeah,
it's I literally tell people, I was like, a homeless person actually could become call themselves a life coach and start making money from it.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's wise to get some kind of a certification and get some kind of credibility that you actually have the skill set. Mm-hmm. I think it just morally saying that you're a life coach, but also being able to show that you have the skill set to be able to help people get free, help people.
Yeah.
Go after what they want. And then therapy is oftentimes taking a look at where you've been so that we can get you to where you want to go. Obviously, it deals a lot with emotional and mental health and pathology, symptoms that a life coach, unless they're skilled in that area, wouldn't be incredible mm-hmm. to be able to walk somebody through. Mm-hmm. And so if you're looking for accountability and somebody to kind of pull you along, champion you along the way, life coaching is great. But if you need a therapist, if it's trauma, you're struggling with depression or anxiety, that wouldn't necessarily be the person, a life coach wouldn't necessarily be the person mm-hmm. to go see. Mm-hmm. But again, it's nuanced because everybody has different credibility and certifications and qualifications. And so yeah. I'm a therapeutic and life coach.
Yeah, so there's definitely different methods of coaching yes. as well. Because I yes. think me as a coach, I definitely go into a bit of a therapeutic approach.
Yes.
But I have a lot of knowledge in it from experiencing right. it. But because I think sometimes, and I think this will lead into us talking about the nervous system, talking about trauma, because you've done a lot of training in it. I notice like you can give people a lot of information about identity and a lot of information. People could listen to so many podcasts mm-hmm. and a lot of the times the block is we're not connected to ourselves. We're right. not connected to our emotions. And I think for the last couple of years, I've been really learning about the nervous system mm-hmm. and how much that plays a part in transformation mm-hmm. and actually integrating a belief system. And so I'd love to hear from you, like what you've learned about the nervous system.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Basically, the nervous system is like the command and control center mm-hmm. of your entire body, soul. And it's made up of the central nervous system. This is a throwback to science, biology. Mm-hmm. Central nervous system, which is your brain and your spinal cord. And then the peripheral nervous system, which contains all of the, I don't know how many, millions, billions probably of nerves that mm-hmm. go all throughout your body from the top of your head to the tip of your toes. And basically these nerves are transmitting information back up to your brain through your spinal cord so that you make the appropriate decision, mm-hmm. behavior. Your body regulates the temperature. It makes you sweat when you're nervous. Mm-hmm. It puts you in fight or flight when you need to get away from something. It calms you back down. And so that part of your nervous system is continually sending in information, like transmitting information both outside of your body and inside of your body to your brain. Mm. And then your brain is responding to mm-hmm. those cues. And so the nervous system, if it literally dictates everything that we think, feel, and do, it's really important to be able to pay attention mm-hmm. to it and to know the state of our nervous system so that we're not just grinding in fight or flight and we're anxious all the time and we're going and we're not actually aware of our bodies that mm-hmm. Our teeth are constantly clenched and our heart rate is always really high and we're always kind of like fidgeting and mm-hmm. busy. And we might just think, oh, that's just life. This is how I'm wired. But when you take into consideration the nervous system and how our nervous system is meant to kind of take us into those moments, because there's nothing wrong with being in a place of fight or flight, that's actually an adaptive response to a situation or a circumstance.
Yes.
But the quote unquote danger is when we stay in those states. And so, and so many of us do unknowingly, some more so than others, if you've have unprocessed trauma and you're in that state of fight or flight because it's actually become protective and you never had a moment where you learned to or you were able to come back down to that place of rest and digest. So another biology lesson is part of your, the two parts of your autonomic nervous system are your sympathetic and your parasympathetic. And that sympathetic is that fight or flight, it's that mobilizing part of your nervous system that is, we need that part. Mm-hmm. I always explain, like, if my kid is running out into in front of a car, my nervous system, my autonomic nervous system kicks in. I go into sympathetic and I grab and my heart rate goes up. My my vision gets super focused, that laser focus, so that I can pull him back out into safety.
Yeah.
But the danger is if I don't learn how to come back from a moment like that and process the anxiety that I felt, the fear that I felt, we can get stuck in that state. And then all of a sudden it's 2 years later and I don't let my kid, and anytime we're around cars, I'm constantly on edge. I'm freaked out. I'm triggered essentially because I didn't actually get to process that moment in a way where my parasympathetic could, the parasympathetic is the rest and digest, mm-hmm. calm and respond. And a healthy nervous system moves from sympathetic to parasympathetic, sympathetic to parasympathetic all day long.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's your alarm wakes up, that's your sympathetic being activated and mobilizing you.
Yeah.
But after your alarm goes off, rather than just jumping straight on your phone, scrolling, so your brain is starting to kind of get already into that fight or flight mode, maybe. Okay, my alarm goes off. I put my alarm down, take a couple of deep breaths. I wake up, maybe stretch for a second, make my coffee. It's that parasympathetic coming back in to calm down.
Yes.
My kids wake up. Okay, my sympathetic kicks back in because I got to mobilize. I got to do something. And then the parasympathetic. And so we're learning how to navigate our nervous systems and befriend our nervous systems is actually paying attention to what's going on inside of our bodies and responding to those states. And so, I mean, if I were to break down, I've did a lot of training in polyvagal theory, which is basically the neurobiology of connection. And we all know what it feels like to be in fight or flight, that anxious, I mean, the fight is the angry, aggressive, frustrated, irritated, even controlling part of that system is when we feel threatened, we go into fight. The flight is anxious, maybe avoiding, maybe even just physiologically feeling really on edge. Our heart is kind of racing all the time. And so that's the fight or flight state. But there's a freeze state that I don't think is as common or not a lot of people talk about it. And a lot of times in trauma, we're dealing a lot with freeze because if we're in fight or flight for so long, fight or flight, again, like I said, it's good to learn how to mobilize ourselves to take action.
Yes.
But if we learn that no matter what we do, whether we fight or whether we try and get away from it, that this threat isn't going away, our nervous systems are smart enough to be able to shut down. And this is that picture of like when a deer is getting chased by a lion and it's trying to get away and it's trying to fight back or it's trying to run away. And then it realizes that I'm about to get eaten alive. And you just kind of see it flop in the lion's mouth. And so it plays dead. And it's the animal's nervous system shutting down so that at least if it gets eaten alive, it's not going to hurt as bad.
Like
you actually see the systems in the body shut down. And this is what happens oftentimes in trauma when the person realizes that they can't get away, they can't do anything about it. This is here to stay. I feel powerless in this situation. And so if I have to still remain here, my body is going to shut down so that at least it can protect itself. And so that's where we see presentations of apathy and numbness and dissociation.
Yes.
Not being present in our own bodies, being really checked out, like just kind of blank stares. And this obviously exists on a spectrum.
Yeah.
I go into freeze sometimes when my kids are throwing fits all day and they're whining and I'm feeling like nothing that I do or say is fixing this and I'm just going to check out. Like,
yeah,
husband gets home and I am done. Like, and I go into my room for I'm going to take a 5-minute break and I'm not connected to myself. I'm checked out. I'm scrolling on my phone. I'm just a little bit numb.
Yeah.
And so it's not always trauma you go into freeze, but it's basically our nervous system's way of protecting us.
Yeah.
And when we can look at how these states are actually protecting us from either real or perceived threat, then we can understand where we are on that spectrum, and we can actually have tools to come out of either of those states.
Yes.
And so the last state, I know I've been talking for a while, is the ventral state.
Yeah.
So there's fight or flight, which is that parasympathetic activation. There's what's called dorsal, which is basically that shutdown freeze state. But then there's a beautiful part of our nervous system called ventral. And that is where we feel, that's that parasympathetic. We're calm, we're connected. I mean, there's a lot of C words that I can use. We're calm, connected, curious, compassionate. What are other C words?
I think you said creative.
Creative.
Yes.
I don't know if I said curious, but where we're basically just connected. We feel, and with clients, I get them to name their states. And so ventral connected states could be called peaceful and present. Mm. When I'm in my peaceful and present state, I'm connected to myself. I'm open to being connected to other people. But when I'm in my fight or flight state, I have a client who calls it her state of stress and survival.
Yeah.
Like that activated, I'm stressed out. I feel like I'm in survival mode. And then the shutdown, oftentimes people use very visceral words to describe freeze, like dark gray state, disconnected, numb, and being able to know what state you're in is helpful to be able to come back to a place of connection. And so that's the long, short answer to what is the nervous system.
I love that you articulated this because I think in life coach space, it's important for life coaches to know this because I think where people give up is they're like, why can't I, even with accountability, I keep not doing the same, the thing that I want to do, or I don't have dreams or vision, or I'm so in survival mode that I don't have any excitement for life.
Right.
And it's so important for us to be aware of this information because sometimes we're shaming ourselves because we're like, oh, I'm so lazy. But you might be in a freeze state.
Yes.
And that's good information to know, to get curious about so that you can come back to that calm and present state.
Yeah. That's literally talking about this with I have a membership called Thrive and we meet as a group on Fridays. And I just came from there and we were talking about freeze and how freeze is very protective. Like sometimes even we have a season where we go into a bit of freeze because we're in survival mode. We don't have a lot of resources maybe to show up and be present and be connected. And so when we come out of a season where we've been in survival mode for a long time, we almost have to like reorient ourselves to ourselves again.
Yeah.
And I gave this picture this morning, like coming out of a freeze state is oftentimes like, you know, those big ice cubes on Frozen, like the massive ice blocks, is kind of like, looks like that. How do I actually melt a ice block? It doesn't happen overnight. You don't just like make one choice and then that thing is broken. And even if you were able to shatter that thing, oftentimes it can feel really jarring to yank ourselves out of a freeze state that has actually been very protective of us for a very long time. We didn't just go into freeze because we chose it. It's protected us somehow. The dissociation, the numbness, the apathy, the not caring, the being really disconnected, the not dreaming, the not hoping. Maybe in a season where you're going through a divorce or a loss, that thing actually protected you. And so coming out of that state is a process of how do I show up every single day and gradually begin to melt the freeze mm-hmm. state. And coming out of a freeze state oftentimes, not always, looks different than coming out of a fight or flight. When you're in fight or flight, I kind of describe it as you're like a really, really blown up balloon. Like mm-hmm. at which any moment, if you keep putting air in that thing is going to pop. Or you even put it on a piece of grass, that thing is going to pop. And so coming out of fight or flight, that anxious, sympathetic, aggressive state oftentimes looks like doing something to decrease the amount of air in that balloon. Like putting on music or going for a walk, getting outside, something that like takes the air out of that balloon. But coming out of a freeze state looks very different. I kind of describe it as a deflated balloon. Mm. It has no air in it. So how do you actually put some energy, like coming out of fight or flight is you're trying to decrease the amount of energy in your body. And coming out of freeze is you're almost trying to increase the amount of energy in your body. And that might look like, I have clients who say, like putting on loud music, like blasting loud music, getting outside, rolling the windows down and going on a drive, or drinking like a really cold glass of water, going for a run. Coming out of fight or flight oftentimes might look like doing yoga or meditation, mm-hmm. but getting out of that dorsal shutdown freeze looks like you're just, I don't know, going to CrossFit or going on a sprint because you're trying to bring energy back inside the body.
Yeah. It's so, I mean, because I even notice the nervous system in exciting things, because mm-hmm. we can talk about like trauma, because I've gone through things where like I've had really exciting things happen in my life, or even just for performers, because I work with a lot of artists, right. like getting up and performing, there's so much adrenaline. And like, I've heard, and maybe you can speak into this, that like sometimes your body doesn't know, because it's so much cortisol going through
right,
your body,
right.
like what the difference is,
right.
you know? So how do we kind of communicate to ourselves or become aware of even when we're doing so many, like I have clients that perform all the
right,
time
right.
and then wonder why they have these big crashes.
Right.
And so can you kind of speak into that?
I mean, that's so interesting that you brought up the, I don't want to say positive or negative, but that when we have good experiences,
yeah.
that it can send us into these sympathetic states as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is oftentimes where the addictive cycle
yes.
can kick in too, when mm-hmm. I was even talking about this too this morning, just jumping from mountaintop to mountaintop,
yes.
because it's giving you that dopamine high. It's giving yep. you that rush. And it is, you're going into fight or flight, especially as performers, because you are having to perform. Like you're having to show up, and sometimes you're coming out of like just everyday life and then you have to perform.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's, this is me externally processing, but I think it's the same either way, both positive and negative experiences. And it's being really attuned
mm-hmm.
with and connected to our bodies. Because I know when I'm in fight or flight based on how my body is presenting. Like I do this thing in my jaw where I kind of, it's like an offset teeth grind.
Yeah.
And my jaw is in like this state, and I have to be aware of, oh, I'm doing that thing again. And just the releasing of that jaw, I'll clench, like I can feel it now because I'm like a little bit nervous coming on mm-hmm. here. Like my stomach is clenched and I can like feel myself in fight or flight, mm-hmm. but not in a bad way, in a
right.
way where I'm being called upon to, I don't want to say the word perform, but perform.
Yeah,
essentially.
To be in a new situation.
Yes.
Or I think that, yeah, teaching or speaking
right.
definitely evokes that thing.
Right.
But I just had this experience where I knew like it was such a exciting thing, but because I've been learning how to tune into my body, I was like, this energy in some ways, even though it's all very exciting and good things, I just want to feel grounded.
Yeah.
So, because I think when you start learning how to be grounded and present and calm, there's just a state of peace mm-hmm. that feels really
yeah.
kind of, I mean, addictive is a strong word, but you kind of like
regulating.
Regulating, yeah. You mentioned survival mode, and I know for me, a lot of my life I lived in survival mm-hmm. mode, and whether that was feeling like, yeah, walking on eggshells or like treading water or whatever, like, or financially feel like you're putting out fires all the time. Do you have some examples of what living in survival mode is? So I just want people who, like, when I found out, oh, this is survival mode, like, it gave me like a sense of peace of like, this is what I'm struggling with. Like, do you have some examples of survival mode?
Yeah. I'm going to just rewind a second because I wanted to answer your question about the positive experiences. Yeah. And you kind of almost were talking about how it feels really, really exciting, but then you feel like almost like you crash at the end. So how do you kind of stop that crash from happening? And I think with any perceived or real threat, and a threat could be like coming out of this podcast and the threat is like, I want to be articulate. I want to, whatever. I want to not stumble over my words. Mm-hmm. Is after this on the way home, and you've probably done this too after teaching, or especially at the beginning when you're teaching and it just feels really vulnerable where you're having to kind of turn on and show up, is how do you actually connect and come back down? And oftentimes for me, it's driving home in complete silence. And rather than I could just throw on a podcast or turn on some music, but that would actually keep me in that state. And so I read this book. I don't know if I would recommend it depending on people's belief systems or whatever.
Yeah.
But it's called Burnout and it's the secret to completing the stress cycle. And it's done by these, I think one of them is a PhD. The other one does, I think, some like somatic body work, but they talk about the stress cycle and how everything in life is about learning how to complete this cycle, which is we always face stressors, whether that's trying to get my kid to school on time, picking them up on time, going on a coaching call, being in the rush of bedtime, dinner, whatever. Like, this is my life, so I'm using it as an example, is there's that stressor and then we go into a little bit of fight or flight, but then we always have to figure out a way to complete that cycle. And so it's after drop off, okay, I got him there on time, thank God. Driving home, I'm just going to take a couple of deep breaths. I got him there, we're good, we can move on with the day, rather than we just, that loop doesn't get closed and we're continually in that activated fight or flight. And so even for performers, like after the performance, how are we coming back into regulation and not just almost eating off that high and staying on that high to the place where we're going from high to high to high, then we crash? Because at the end of the day, our nervous systems have to regulate themselves. And if we don't regulate them in a healthy and sustainable way, that's where we do experience those crashes. I remember even in my university, every single Christmas and summer, I would get really, really sick because I wasn't learning how to actually manage my body in a sustainable way to where I had to crash because your nervous system is going to speak to you no matter what. And if you're not paying attention to it, it's going to kind of just shut down on you, which is where you get all these physical and adrenal fatigue and all these different presentations of your nervous system needing to come back down. Mm. And so I think positive or negative experiences, learning how to be tuned in enough to your body to know how to have regulating strategies, whether that's breathing, quiet, exercise, movement, creativity, connection, co-regulation is a huge thing.
Yeah.
And I don't think people talk about it enough. I think a lot of times we're in the self-help, emotionally healthy space, we're talking a lot about self-regulation. Mm. But self-regulation doesn't happen unless we first have co-regulation. Like if you think about a baby coming into the world, they don't know how to self-regulate.
Yep.
And the co-regulation of skin to skin actually is the bedrock and sets the foundation for that baby and that toddler and that kid and that grown-up to be able to self-regulate. And so for ourselves, we need to regulate with other people, calling a friend, just having somebody sit with us as we process our pain, having a coach or a therapist who can give us safe spaces where our nervous systems tune into theirs, we co-regulate, and from there we can kind of reconnect and self-regulate.
Yeah, it's because we're made for connection,
right?
Like we actually need it, and so I love that. So how? Like how, what are some ways that you feel regulated? How do you create? I mean, you've mentioned some of them.
Yeah. I think breathing for me, and it sounds so woo-woo and lame, but helps me come back into my body. I tend towards fight or flight. Mm. Flight specifically, anxiety, control, feeling like I have to kind of be 10 steps ahead of the game all the time. And so breathing takes me out of, like, when I'm anxious and stressed, I'm outside of the present moment because I'm trying to manage different worlds and my kids and so many different things. And so breathing helps me get back into my body, reconnect with myself. Sunlight is a really big thing for me. Going into the room in my house with the most sunlight is my bedroom. And so just taking a couple of seconds in there, having like a cold or hot drink. Tea. I've been drinking like a lot of tea lately, and it's just something, having that cup in your hand, really regulating strategies or anything that brings you back into the present moment, brings you back into your body. I don't know, what would they be for you?
Oh, I call them cozy moments.
Oh, I love cozy moments.
And so, like, I had a client who was feeling like they moved into a new place and they were so homesick. Mm. And I was like, oh, just create a corner in your home.
Yes.
Or whether it's in your bedroom or something that feels like a spot that's cozy.
Yeah.
Get a blanket, get a candle.
Yes, like, a candle.
I'm all about like cozy experiences. Yeah. And I'm similar to you. I love a good morning routine. But camping.
I can't. I know you talk about this. I can't.
I was not a camper. I was not a camper.
And I get
I'm not really like I say I'm camping and I've been like twice.
Yes.
But I think I would have been, if someone said to me, come camping, I would have gone because my friends like that, mm-hmm. not because I like that. But then I remember I was just before the school year started and I was learning about the nervous system, mm-hmm. and I was like, I'm going to go to the camping and I'm just going to...
See,
I'm not a camper, obviously, but we live in Reading and there's lots of mountains and it actually is really beautiful. But we're city girls.
Yes.
We love the city vibes.
We do love the
and
city
the beach.
Vibes.
And the beach. Yeah. But and so I went camping and I remember everything got quiet in me. Mm-hmm. Just I felt surrounded by nature and I actually became aware of what it was doing to my internal world. And I actually came from a really triggering conflict. Yeah. Like, and then I went straight into camping where I had no access to my phone. Mm-hmm. And I got so connected to myself. And I remember being on like the kayak and the because the kayak on the water, like you rock back and forward. And I know like moms with babies, when they're holding, they're soothing their baby, they actually rock and often tap their child.
Yeah.
You know,
on the booty.
On the booty. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And there's this, that's actually soothing them. Yeah. But we as adults need that kind of soothing as well. And it actually, I went back to work and had such a big capacity to handle the gnarly situation. Whereas like old Ella would have been obsessing my whole weekend about the situation, whereas that situation took me out of that. So I just kind of built a value of like nature and being outside.
Yeah.
Probably more so.
Yeah.
But yeah, tea is...
I think, I feel like what you're describing is like there's our autonomic nervous system and then there's our somatic nervous system, and it's all part of the peripheral nervous system again. But it's what you're describing is the integration of the two. Like the autonomic is that fight or flight, respond. It's our involuntary response to our circumstances and experiences. It happens subconsciously without our knowing. But the somatic part of our nervous system is everything that we can control. Mm. Our breathing, how we hold our bodies, how we, this is why even like progressive muscle relaxation is where we are integrating that autonomic nervous system where we can't always control whether we're, our heart rate's going up, where our body is clenching, but we're integrating that somatic part of our nervous system through, okay, I'm going to engage with, I'm feeling anxious. I didn't put myself here. My circumstances put myself here, but I'm going to use my body, regulating strategies, cozy moments. A lot of times regulation is using our sensory systems, mm-hmm. like touch, taste, see, feel, smell. Like camping is a very sensory yeah. experience and almost a desensory experience because mm-hmm. we live in such a noisy world with our phones
yes.
and it's just, we're always have access and we're always accessible. And so turning down the noises of our senses mm-hmm. oftentimes integrates us back to ourselves. And so even, it's not like we can just go camping every single weekend, maybe if right. you can.
Yeah.
But how can you almost take those, that experience and integrate that into your everyday life of having, you don't look at your phone after a certain time, or you don't listen to music, you don't have music listening. I've been doing that lately where I don't have music playing in my house. Usually I have like a jazz or like a lo-fi, yeah. but realizing that I'm so sensory overloaded with three small children at home and the house is full that I actually need less sensory input. And so turning that down
yes.
is very regulating.
Yeah, that's so good. I love how practical we're being because I think once you start getting aware, like it just, you look for other ways that are unique to you to help calm yeah. your nervous system,
right.
like what you actually like.
Yes.
And so I think like you shared this story on your Instagram about your journey with Kobe, who's your middle son. Mm-hmm. So you have two boys, Zion and Kobe, and mm-hmm. then sweet Zara. Yeah. She's one.
She's one, my girl. Oh,
your girl.
Yeah.
She's so cute. Anyway, so Kobe was born in 2020
mm-hmm.
and everyone was kind of in lockdown mode and yeah. you had some medical issues that came up. Mm-hmm. So I'd love to, especially because I actually coach clients that are moms mm-hmm. that are dealing with hard stuff with their kids.
Yeah.
And as you were kind of talking about your journey with Kobe, I was like, I don't even have kids, but I'm like, this is so helpful mm-hmm. to know what little kids need at a young age. You can yeah. even have compassion for yourself of like, oh, I never got that.
Right.
When I was little. But yeah, tell us about the story there of what yeah. happened and then the dysregulation and getting to regulated
yeah.
with him.
Yeah.
yeah.
Yeah. In 2020, he was born in May. He was 2 weeks old when his stomach just started getting really, really distended. Long story short, we took him into the ER. They airlifted him immediately and got taken down to Davis. He was diagnosed with a condition basically of his intestines. And it was really, really scary. He had a whole bunch of different procedures and tests and eventually a couple of surgeries to reverse or to fix this issue. All within 2 weeks. We were there initially for 2 weeks. And then we had another visit and we've had a couple of visits since then. So every year we've had to do this emergency visit. Either we're airlifted or we're driving down really fast down to Davis to get him seen because it's very, like the condition itself isn't life-threatening, but the infection that can happen in his body can progress really, really quickly. And it's very serious mm-hmm. if we don't catch it fast enough. And so he had these surgeries. We bring him home. Life goes back to quote unquote normal. But every time we're coming back from the hospital, we're just noticing more and more just dysregulation in him. There was I think when I was pregnant with Zara, he would wake up 3 or 4 times a night, like just screaming hysterically, no rhyme or reason. We tried everything. We took out naps and it just felt very out of our control.
How old was he at this stage?
He was 2.
Oh, 2.
Yeah. Early 2.
Yeah.
Because I was pregnant with Zara. And so now he's 3 in a bit. And I just felt like his nervous system was in kind of like fight or flight. Like I was just noticing that he just needed more connection and closeness. And so we would sleep in his bed. We would let him sleep on us. I was just really conscious of helping him co-regulate. I feel like I'm not giving it justice right now because I'm trying to kind of remember too back then. He would wake up 4 times a night just screaming. And I just really felt like he needed to be closer to us. And every time he would come back from the hospital, even with his food and his diet, more and more things would get cut out because it's this, I mean, before you can articulate threat and pain, pre-verbal, everything is still happening in your nervous system. And through a process called neuroception and interoception. So neuroception is our ability to pick up external cues and identify whether they're cues of safety or cues of danger. And then interoception is our body's internal ability to pick up on cues of safety or danger coming from inside our bodies. And because he had so much threat at an early age, like just lights being shone on him. Like he was 2 weeks old when he was having surgeries and doctors were like pushing in tools and instruments. And I just felt like his nervous system had trauma that needed to be healed. But obviously it's all pre-verbal, so he can't tell me any of these things. I'm just, as a mom, picking up things where I'm recognizing he had trauma that needs to be healed. And trauma is a wound that needs safety, because that's human beings' number one need is safety and connection, and connection, safety through connection and co-regulation. And so how can I make him feel safe? Obviously, I'm a human and I can't control everything externally. Like there's that reality, but just, I was so intentional in that season about creating safety externally and internally and as best as I could to heal the wound that was done pre-verbally outside of anybody's control. And we've noticed, I mean, we did a lot of, we would sleep in his bed, we would turn on music, like calming worship music all throughout the night. And his sleep quickly got better in that season. Once I kind of identified, I think there's like an attachment wound that happened that none of us can articulate properly because it's not like we understood, we could control it. It was outside of our control. But when you think about a baby's needs for consistent skin to skin, there was many days where I wasn't able to nurse, where he wasn't allowed any food at all. And when you think about the sensitivity of that time and a baby needing attachment, needing co-regulation, needing closeness, warmth, body, he didn't have that for many weeks of his life. Yeah. And so it was almost about me trying to, I don't want to say, but reversing the effects, repairing the attachment trauma that happened.
Yeah. I think that's really important because I think a lot of parents can feel like my kid's just acting out. They need more discipline.
Right.
Or they feel a sense of hopelessness.
Yeah.
And so I think when I heard that story, I was like, actually, this feels quite simple, because I remember you were going through that journey and I remember seeing his countenance change in that time. Like he became like such a
confident,
spunky, so much personality. Like his brightness came back.
Yeah.
And I think, sometimes, and no shame to parents because it's out of control.
It's hard out here.
It's hard. But I think just when I heard your story, I was like, oh, so many people need to hear that. Oh, it could just be learning how to repair the attachment.
Right.
Yeah.
And you're looking past the behavior and you're looking for the need.
Yeah.
And at that age, we're always communicating attachment needs because we are social beings who need connection. But especially when they're little, they're always attachment needs. Mm. Are you here for me or will you leave me when I'm not okay?
Yes.
And it wasn't my job at the time to be like, well, we're a good family and he has a good sleeping environment and mm-hmm. he's not in the hospital anymore. Like all these logical cognitive ways yeah. that we try and, like the body isn't cognitive. Mm-hmm. The body is sensory. Mm-hmm. And we communicate those needs through our words, but when you don't have them, they come out in behavior. Mm-hmm. And so it was about kind of attuning and discerning his need
yeah.
for a healed attachment, for more attachment and closeness yeah. and regulation that he maybe didn't get in that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I think the fear might be, oh my gosh, I have to have him sleep in the bed every single right. night for the rest of it. And now he's going to be a teenager and still yeah. sleeping in the bed. And like our fear can kind of go there. But actually, he just got to a point where he felt safe and he was able to sleep in his own bed.
Yeah.
Is that what happened?
Yeah. And we had to throw, because I'm a very by the book mom. Like
yeah.
None of my kids have slept in my bed. I'm not a co-sleeper. I do the sleep. I don't even want to say sleep training on here because the moms might come after me.
There's so much mom shame out there.
Yes. Yeah. But we had, with trauma, the rules have to go out the window because yeah. it's not a normal presentation of behavior because yeah. there has been a rupture and a wound
yeah.
to the body, soul, spirit, to the psyche, to the yep. well-being, safety, and attachment system of a person. And I knew that. And so I was like, I'm actually healing the wound and not creating a crutch.
Yeah.
And once the safety was reestablished and once yes. the attachment felt safe, then he was able to go back. He's been sleeping in his bed through the night ever since. And we've right. had he's not in our bed mm-hmm. consistently anymore.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Such a great testimony. I think, how did you as a mom, because I can just imagine when I become a mom, like just the fear that can happen in those big moments, mm-hmm. like how did you regulate your own nervous system through those experiences?
Yeah, I've had moments to reflect and process. And obviously we did some trauma therapy after that.
Yeah.
Because it was just very tumultuous. I was driving behind the helicopter on the phone with my mom, not knowing if he was going to be okay. But I say this now and I don't know if I've meant it up until now, but I'm like, maybe it could change. I don't know. I'm always evolving and things are always coming up. Sometimes I'll get even Zara was, my daughter was constipated the other day and both of my husband and I were like, we actually felt a little bit triggered because
yeah.
Kobe's stuff was all to do with his gut and yeah. all that. And so both of us felt a little bit more heightened when Zara wasn't pooping on her own because we've been through this
yes.
quote unquote traumatic experience. But I say this, that I don't think I got traumatized by it. And there's a very wide range amount of definitions of trauma. And there's people who hear a trauma, there a trauma, everywhere a trauma, trauma. Everybody has trauma.
I know. And it's a little
bit. My trauma. I have trauma.
A little and self. Yeah.
Yes.
It's a bit, maybe it was just stressing, not traumatic.
And I think, yes. And I think yeah. the word trauma feels validating. Like when
yeah.
you can say, oh, that was trauma.
Yeah.
And so my job as a helper, as a counselor, as a coach, isn't to be like, well, according to the DSM and or according to the definition of trauma, that wasn't trauma. Like
right.
if that helps you process, then yeah. great.
But and
then
some of it is stockpiled.
Yes.
Like
complex.
You keep having, yes. is that what it's called?
Complex. Yeah. I mean, if it's that it's, complex PTSD.
Yeah, yeah. Like you've had multiple mm-hmm. situations that feel a bit related.
Right.
You know.
Then your yeah. trauma is triggering more and more.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I would say that I didn't feel traumatized because I mean, it was a 2 week point where we were in the hospital. We were away from our firstborn, but I was on my phone all the time, constantly texting my friends and people in my life and my community, and people were always checking in. And I was always, every day I was processing what happened that day. And
yes.
this is what happened. This is the procedure that he went through. My heart is breaking at watch. Like I was constantly on my phone messaging people. And when I left, yes, there was some, we had to kind of reorient back into normal life after a traumatic experience, but I myself didn't feel traumatized because I was seen. Like, I think that co-regulation, that I was able to borrow people's nervous systems in that season where I felt like, even when I would feel myself starting to kind of lose it or get stuck, I was calling somebody, I was sending a voice message, I was processing out what had happened to where that trauma, I feel like, was able to move through my body and not get stuck in it.
Yes.
And maybe I say, maybe I won't believe this. And I'm like, maybe some pieces got stuck. Like, even when we saw Zara constipated, it was like, oh, I can feel a little bit of that trauma being kind of poked on, but not enough for it to feel like it being something that is there, and it's scary, and I feel very triggered all the time.
Yeah.
And so I think for myself, that co-regulation part was a huge safeguard. Mm. Like, it felt like that connection and that co-regulation felt like it built up this like security blanket around myself. When, and not everybody has that in traumatic moments. And that's the thing where we get stuck in trauma, is when trauma doesn't have a way to move through our bodies or move through our psyches, it gets stuck.
Yes.
And it gets trapped in there. And all we're left with, because when we're in a traumatic experience, the narrative memory and the sensory memory disconnect from each other. And so our ability to put an experience into words actually gets disconnected from the sensory fragments, which is the sound of the helicopter. I remember when we even got home, a sound of a helicopter, I would feel my body get sad. And so processing trauma is about reintegrating the narrative memory and the sensory experiences together in a cohesive, coherent story. But I think because I was able to process in real time the trauma, that those, the narrative and the sensory, never had a chance to fragment and disconnect from each other.
Yes.
And so that experience for me has a coherent narrative because I was continually processing it out. Mm-hmm. And again, there's like little sensory fragments, like the helicopter sound, even just constipated doctors, sometimes going to the hospital or going to the doctors, or when we have to go back to the hospital, I can feel the sensory feeling, but again, it has a story attached to it. So the reason why trauma is so detrimental is because those sensory fragments have nowhere else to go. And so they oftentimes just come back in flashbacks and nightmares and triggers and body experiences where we feel unsafe and we're trying to protect ourselves. But so I think, long story long, to answer your question, I think the protective factor in that time was that I was able to integrate the very scary sensory trauma that was happening, but I was able to process it in real time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so helpful, because I think even as everyone is listening, you're getting a bit of a framework of how to move through something difficult or creating a like, that there's multiple realities happening. Yeah. Sometimes it's like our fear is the reality.
Right.
And sometimes it's like, actually the fear is just trying to communicate something. Your body's trying to communicate something, and that there's actually a way through it. So I love that you're giving some sort of framework. Mm. Coming back into regulation and all of that, like you have a challenge, which is the morning routine, which is, this is connected into rhythms that help us feel regulated. Mm-hmm. And you've created a challenge called the morning routine. I'd love for you to share about, what prompted that and the benefits.
Yes. I mean, when I was first starting my business, people would always ask me on Instagram. It was the number one question I got. And at time it frustrated me, because I'm like, I don't want to be known for being a morning person. I want to be known for being like a good coach and other things. But everybody was asking me, like, how do you wake up so early? And what are things that you do to help you wake up early? And so because of the constant questions that I was getting, I just created this 5-day early morning routine challenge. And it's basically just a 5-day video-led series of how to actually create a morning routine. And for me, it's, I would always say, how you can show up for yourself before you have to show up for everybody and everything else. Because we do, and depending on the season that you're in, you might have to show up for more people or more things. As a mom, I'm showing up for 3 kids, my husband, my business, different things that I'm saying yes to. And if I want to show up for those things in a way where I'm giving from the overflow, and the overflow meaning I have poured into my own cup first so that I'm not just giving my kids the scraps, because that's where they're getting the frustrated me, the impatient me, the angry me, is if I don't first have a chance to fill up my cup before it has to spill out onto everybody else's. And that's where we start to feel angry and self-righteous, and right. We go into self-protection and people are trying to take from me. Mm-hmm. But I learned that it's because I have to show up for me first.
Yes.
So that I can bring my best, most connected, most full self. So I think of it like I wake up at a 30% every morning, sometimes 20. And my goal of the morning routine is to fill my cup up as much as I can. Maybe not always to 100, usually not, because a kid wakes up early. I don't get the workout in because I'm actually too tired, but I'm listening to my body. And so I'm not going to do it, but to fill up my cup as much as possible so that I can get to a 70 or an 80, so that I get to pour out onto my day mm-hmm. from a 70 instead of a 10. And I forget what the pillars are, but I think it's like a know your needs.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
I've done it. So I should know too.
I should know because it's mine.
Yeah.
But you, I don't remember.
Yeah. Know your needs.
I have one on productivity.
Oh yeah.
Because everybody, I would ask, why do you want to wake up earlier? And so many people want to be more productive.
Yeah.
But the equation of productivity isn't, I forget what it is, but it's basically you have to put in so that you can give out.
Yes.
And so,
true.
When you're trying to be productive, you're not, productivity isn't just a action. Mm-hmm. It's you're using resources that you have to create an impact in whatever it is that you're doing. And so you yourself have to have resources to be able to pull from in order to be productive. So productivity, I think I have one on the practicals of actually creating a morning routine, mm-hmm. knowing what your needs are, because your needs are going to influence how you do your morning. Mm-hmm. If you need quiet, if you need movement, if you need, I don't know, whatever it is that you need to help. Yeah. The morning routine is meant to be personalized and actually work for you.
Yeah.
And it's not, I mean, I wake up very early, but the morning routine is just you're waking up 30 minutes earlier to have a little bit of time to yourself.
Yes. And I think it's like, I notice when I don't wake up early, I'm living in reaction the rest
yes,
of the day.
Yes, reaction. Yeah.
Yeah. Whereas like...
And you're always playing catch up.
Yes. And I read this book. It's called The Morning Book. And they interviewed all these different famous people who get up really early. And it's like just delightful.
Oh,
like
yes.
Such a good read.
They do say that. I think it's like one of the indicators of successful people is people who wake up early.
And I just remember hearing someone say it's like you could, if you get up 3 hours early before everyone else or like whatever, you know, the thing that you need to go to, it's like a vacation in the morning.
Yes.
Like, and to me, I'm like, give me a vacation in the morning.
Yes.
You know, and like, yeah, it's like a place of, and I'm trying to be intentional about not so much listening. Sometimes, yeah, the podcasting is helpful because if you wake up anxious or you wake up and you need to like listen to something, I try to read or journal or write so that I'm not just like scrolling on social media.
Right. Earlier. Or just kind of going on an autopilot and you're not actually connecting.
Yes. We love the word connected.
We love it.
Yeah. We love it. So you mentioned the word showing up.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a pain point that a lot of us have faced as we are in the human experience is people not showing up for us or not being there for us. So I love you kind of like say it a lot on your social media of like showing up to life because it's something sometimes when we're not receiving it from other people, we're not doing it for ourselves.
Right.
We're not attracting that because we're not showing up.
Right.
I know the more I've showed up for my life, myself, the more people show up for me.
Yeah.
And so tell me a bit about practically what showing up for yourself looks like.
Yeah. I was talking about this again this morning.
Yeah.
Feels like this is very aligned with what I was talking about this morning in my community. But showing up is to me about facing what's in front of you, facing your reality.
Yeah.
And I think so often in the human experience, we don't know how to face the reality of what's in front of us. And we're trying to either check out from it or escape from it. Yeah. Checking out being like, you just live on the autopilot. You're disconnected. You're not present. You're on your phone. You're whatever, checking out in whatever. You're not waking up early. You're staying up too late and just watching shows and binge watching. And you're just doing that in that same cycle. Or escaping is you're just always planning the next thing that you want to do. I was literally talking this morning about how sometimes we, in order to show up and face what's in front of us, oftentimes looks like we're just living in the mundane. It's just the everyday grind. But if we're trying to live a thriving, abundant life, we have to find it in the everyday and not just in the mountaintops. Because if we're chasing the mountaintop top experiences, like I was saying, that's when we get into this addictive cycle of we actually can't be present.
Yeah.
And we're only okay if everything is going right for us. And so I was saying, like, a vacation to inspire you, like, because I'm planning like a little trip for my family because I just want us to go to the mountains and stay in a cabin. Mm-hmm. And I'm planning this and it's giving me actually more energy to show up in the here and now versus can't wait to get to that cabin. It's fine. Like, we're just going to, at the end of the month, we're going to the cabin. Like, and it's actually causing to you to escape. So it can be the same presentation, but what is the heart of it? How showing up to me is I wake up every single day and I find ways to engage with my life. Mm-hmm. And some days it's easier. In some seasons when things are going well and my marriage is flowing and my kids are sleeping through the night, like showing up to my day, like I can't wait to wake up. And then there's other seasons where I have to continually make the choice to face what's in front of me, show up to the life in front of me, stay in reality at all costs rather than checking out, shutting down. My tendency isn't to escape. My tendency is to check out and to just like want to be alone, scroll on my phone at the end of the day, go into autopilot and just do what's in front of me, but not actually engaging in it. It's like, how do I engage with my life in every single season? That's what showing up looks like.
Yeah, that's so awesome. I think we're learning about the nervous system, and I think sometimes we can go into, oh, I need to be regulated all the time.
Yes.
And I need to be perfect. And I think part of even it's like sometimes we can have all this knowledge.
Yeah.
But I think the important thing is you're going to be human and you're going to be triggered. Okay. Like both of us still get triggered.
Yes.
And don't know that we're dysregulated. We think we're not.
Yeah.
And so it's not about perfection, but it's an invitation into a deeper sense of calm and still, you know. So I think in closing, what's your next brave thing?
My next brave thing.
Just to throw that at you.
I don't know if I should say it on here because I haven't announced it yet.
Well, this is coming out like probably March, February.
Okay.
I can always edit it out.
Okay. My next brave thing is I am planning an in-person event.
Oh, that's exciting.
Everything is, and maybe I'll just leave it at that. Yeah. Everything that I've been doing in my business up until now is all online. Mm-hmm. It's all, every program, every client, my Thrive membership, it's all online. I can wear pants on my call or not. And
it's just
from the comfort of my bedroom. And it's just, it feels safe for me because it's what I've been doing, and almost the barrier of the screen is now just safe. It's safe for me to do an online business, but I've felt this, and my husband told me, I think last year, you're going to do an in-person event and I can't wait to plan it. And literally everything inside me said, no, absolutely not. I will never do an in-person event. That will never happen. I'm going to keep my safe online business. But for whatever reason, my heart started shifting towards it, and I started getting excited about how can I take what I've built online and go from just having followers and clients to building a community and bringing people together and sharing experiences. And like, I've even seen people in my membership community follow each other on Instagram. And I'm like, it's inspiring this thing in me of like, I want to create community. I want to create spaces where people come together and connect outside of me. Like, I want to remove myself from being the center of my business and my world. And I want to figure out how to empower people and bring people in to create live experiences, to create actual real life connection. And that feels terrifying to me. As excited as I am about it, anytime I think about it, like everything in my heart sinks. And I either want to go into fight or flight and like, I need to plan this. Or I just want to be like, check out. I don't want to think about it. I can't do it. And so I'm learning how to be where my feet are right now and almost like trust that this is the next brave thing for me. And I was sharing again this morning, like we could stay small in our life, always knowing that there was things that we would have to be accountable to ourselves that we never went after because we were too afraid.
Yeah.
Or because we didn't want to have to feel the risk and the vulnerability and work out the messy middle before we actually get to that thing that we are called to do. And a lot of people don't ever get there because the vulnerability in that brave space is too much to handle. Like the vulnerability of even like teaching in my class, because everything I do is online, but I'm teaching in real time. My biggest fears, and I shared this with my class, was like, I don't know what to do with my hands. Like, you're seeing my whole body. Like, nobody's ever seen my chest down.
Yeah.
And I cross my legs in my client sessions because I can. And so the vulnerability was people seeing all of me and me not knowing where to put my hands. And do I stand out from the podium or do I like stay behind it to be protected?
Yeah.
And it's another level of this vulnerability. Now people are going to see me because I want to do a retreat. They're going to see me in the house with my makeup off and my
face.
Yes. Everything.
And that you're tall.
Yes.
You're not sure. You know?
It's very vulnerable to be seen.
Totally.
And so
that's like when I meet my clients in real life, they're like, oh, you're tall.
You are very tall. That is very true.
I'm 5'9".
Yes, you are.
Yeah. How tall are you?
5'7".
Oh. For some reason, I think you're my height, but you're not.
No.
Yeah. Anyway. Thanks for joining.
This is good. This is so good. We have such good conversations
we
nerd out. I think both of us are nerds at heart.
Yes, because we love integration.
Yes.
Being whole.
Being whole. Free. And figuring out the barriers to that.
Yes. And I just think of our friendship and how far both of us have come. Like where we are now versus where we were in the beginning. And I just, so grateful for you and for both our evolution that we get to be in process, that we get to evolve. And I'm excited for what you're launching in the future. How can people find you?
You can find me on the only platform on social I'm on is Instagram. I have a YouTube, Chantel E. Nelson.
Yes.
And my website for coaching things, to be a part of Thrive membership, which is my community and heart education membership, is comealivelifecoaching.com.
Yes. And we'll put the links in the show notes, but thank you so much for coming on today.
Thanks for having me.
You're amazing. Great, great, great. The end.
The end.
Thanks for listening today. Please download, share with your friends, and write a review. If you would like to book in a life coaching session with me, go to my website at www.ella-hooper.com or follow me on Instagram at Next Brave Thing Podcast.